Welcome to the Mike Gormley Show. Mike Gormley is the founder of Los Angeles Personal Development, a boutique music management and public relations firm. Mike has achieved top recognition as a journalist, a record company executive, an artist manager, and music supervisor for TV and film. His work has brought the world such successful artists as film composer Danny Elfman, massively successful pop band The Bangles, and helped launch the careers of such diverse artists as Rod Stewart, Rush, BTO, The Police, and Supertramp. Mike Gormley Show brings the world's biggest music icons and management to you. And now, your host, Mike Gormley. This is the Mike Gormley Show in overtime with Randy Backman of the Guess Who and BTO.
Hi, this is Mike Gormley, the Mike Gormley Show, and we are on a podcast segment of the show because we're with Randy Backman, whose career spans several decades, and we've got a lot to talk about. So let's jump into just what it was like, you know, the whole, you're getting your guitar just found after decades of it missing. And maybe you can fill in a little bit more about what went on at that time. This was just a couple of years ago, right?
Yes, 2 years ago, I got it back.
Yeah.
It was my first real guitar. The first guitar you get is from the Sears catalog. It's like $39. To save up my money to get a guitar like Duane Eddy played, or Chet Atkins, or Eddie Cochran, the orange Gretsch, the Duane Eddy Chet Atkins Gretsch, with a big deal. One came into Winnipeg, I bought it. Another one came in, Neil Young bought it. He still got his. We both had orange Gretsches. Mine, I played, I learned to play on it and wrote every song and played every song on the record. That's the only guitar I'm taking care of business. At the beginning, it's my backbeat in these eyes. It's everything. It was stolen in 1976, I think, from my hotel room in Toronto. I never got it back. I searched and searched and searched for years. Finally, I gave it up. When COVID came in and we stopped touring, my son and I, Tal, we did a thing called Friday Night Train Wreck as Bachman and Bachman, which if you Google it now on YouTube, we were every Friday at 6 o'clock. He would try to stump me with five songs he knew on acoustic guitar. And I would bring five that I knew that we knew the songs because we heard them on the radio, but we had never played them together. So we would make mistakes and with the wrong key, it was a train wreck. But we loved doing it. And people loved seeing us, professional guys, making mistakes just like they do. Mm-hmm. And everything they hear on the radio is perfection. In the middle of one of these broadcasts, down the side of the thing said, I found your lost Gretsch guitar.
Wow.
So I say to my son, Tal, because we're doing live YouTube, there's a black column where people are typing up stuff. Get a hold of this guy. So we found this guy in White Rock, where we used to live, White Rock, BC, who scoured the internet because he knew I was looking for my lost Gretsch. Well, I had given up after 40 years of it being gone, 45 years of it being gone. He found it on a YouTube of a guy named Takeshi or Takeshi singing Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree in Japan, Tokyo nightclub, two Christmases ago. The guy does not speak English. He's about 33. He's the Japanese Brian Setzer. He's a rockabilly guy, and he's playing my Gretsch. So this guy did facial recognition of my Gretsch from BTO's Looking Up for Number One, which was on YouTube, and took a picture of my Gretsch, and then he compared it with all the other orange Gretsches sold on the internet. So he did a facial recognition of a guitar face. And he sent me this thing of my guitar. Luckily, my son Tal is married to Coco Yamamoto, who's Japanese. Mm-hmm. I can't talk to this guy. She sends him an email in Japanese to his website. He's a very famous Japanese performer and songwriter. And emails back, yes, this is your guitar. I'm an honorable man. I'll give you back your guitar. I say, okay, I'll get one to trade you. I get so lucky. I find this twin guitar made in 1957 with the Armin pickups. The serial number is 2 digits off mine. So it's made by the same guys in the same week. I buy this from Gary's Loveland, Ohio, from Gary's Rare Guitars. And so we fly to Tokyo and we do the switch on Canada Day, July the 1st, 2 years ago. But they won't let me meet Takeshi or see my guitar because they're filming this for a Netflix HBO special, The Lost and Found Guitar. Because with this guitar, I wrote 6 million selling songs with the Guess Who and 6 with BTO. and sold tens of thousands of albums with this guitar, and then it's gone. Then I get it back. Am I getting the magic back? Yes, I am. I got the guitar. It's amazing. When you get your first, it's like getting your bicycle back when you were a kid. You get on it, and this is what you learn to ride on. So,
but it also must have been just horribly heartbreaking when you found out it was gone.
It was gone. It was like looking out your window of your living room, seeing your dog run across the street and getting run over by a truck. It's like, it's that bad. Like, I couldn't sleep. I was up. This guitar was everything to me. It was like, it was my left arm. It was my right arm. It was amazing. That was quite a shakeup. That caused me to go on a Gretsch binge. I ended up buying every Gretsch that was available. I ended up with 350 of them, which I then sold to Fred Gretsch for the Gretsch Museum, which is now in Savannah, Georgia. And they had it on display in Music Row, Music City in Nashville for about a full year. They picked 100 of the Gretsches that everybody was oohing and aahing over because I was on a quest to find mine and never found it. Found it through this weird thing of Takeshi having this YouTube thing that we found.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guitar is back. Now we're finishing up the documentary. And it's good. It's a great story.
It's a fantastic story. And it is going to be on one of the streaming networks, I guess we call them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you'll be contacted when it's done. We're just in final editing right now.
Okay. Fantastic. I'm winging it because we're doing this little extra shot. I wanted to ask about Charlie Fash. We spoke to him about him earlier. He was, I guess at that time, vice president of the Mercury Records. He eventually became president.
Yeah.
Probably because of how many records you sold. And he's, but how did you connect with him? How did you finally get signed as BTO?
When I left the Guess Who, it was 1970. I had a medical issue with gallbladder, so I was out of commission for about 6 to 9 months. And when that summer was over, I was ready to go, but they had replaced me with two guys in the band. They had cut the Share the Land album. They're back on the charts. Neil Young came back to Winnipeg. The Buffalo Springfield had broken up. He was doing a solo album, and he and I were hanging out together, and he plays me Buffalo Springfield acetate and stuff like that, and it's amazing. And I said, I've got to do something, but I don't want to be a second-rate Guess Who. I can't get a better voice than Burton Cummings, who had the greatest voice in rock and roll. One of the greatest.
Amazing rock and roll voices.
Yeah. And I said, I want to do a country thing like Poco or like Buffalo Springfield. And he said, great. So I got a pedal steel guitar player, a violin. I did two albums. We were called Brave Belt. And Neil got me a deal with Mo Austin at Reprise Records. And after two albums, we went nowhere. So I get a notice from Don Schmitzerly, who was running Reprise Records at the time, saying, we've hit a bottom line. We don't want your third album. Meanwhile, I had cut the third album with my own money and didn't have a record deal. So I sent them out. Then you sent out 7.5-inch reels. I sent out reels to everybody just before Christmas and started to get replies back. Very nice, not applicable for our label. Beautiful letterhead with a butterfly from Jack Holtzman at Elektra, a trumpet from A&M Records, the other logos and stuff, all passing on the album. And I had met Charlie Fash earlier in New York City, I think at a radio station. And he said, it's a big mistake for you to use a name, Brave Belt. You got to use your name because radio will recognize your name that you wrote the songs for the Guess Who and you were in the Guess Who. So you got to use Bachman. And I said, well, my new band is three Bachmans and a Turner. He said, call yourself Bachman Turner. So we called Bachman Turner for about a month. But people then were used to seeing Seals and Crofts and Brewer and Shipley, two guys with acoustic guitars and mandolins singing Diamond Girl. And one joke over the line. And we would show up playing this. By then, we had got Fred Turner in the band, who had this Harley Davidson voice like John Fogerty. And we're doing Creedence, and we're doing Stones, we're doing heavy rock. And we needed a heavy name. We found a trucker magazine called Overdrive. And so I wrote to the editor of the magazine, can I use this name for our band? He said, sure, it'll help promote the magazine. We're in different businesses. I'm selling truckers magazines and truck parts. You're selling music. Great. So I called Charlie the next day. I said, okay, I've got the name. And I had written down I got it in a truck stop. So, and I want to write it down, because when you're a songwriter, you got to write down ideas, you forget them. Yeah. So when you get a napkin, they're like this. They fit in those tall aluminum things. So it's a tall, so I write Bachman. Underneath that, I write Turner. And under it, I write Overdrive. So I've got it in my pocket. I called Charlie the next morning on a payphone. Charlie, I got the name. Bachman, turn it over. And he wanted Bachman because he was German, right? His real name is Charlie Fosch. So he wanted Bachman instead of, in Canada, I grew up saying Bachman. And he said, it's too long. And I look at it and go, whoa, BTO. He goes, great. Chicago used to be CTA. Coffee Stills and Nash or CSNN. You can have BTO and Bachman Turn Overdrive. Go get some album pictures taken. So we're now in Vancouver, but we're a prairie band. We're from Winnipeg, which is flat prairie. So we find a hill in Vancouver that's all grass. It's downtown Vancouver. If they go above the hill, you're going to see Vancouver mountains, but we want it to look like the prairie. So we're standing on this hill that's all grass, and it's prairie grass. That's maybe 4 or 5 feet high, and it falls down in the rain. And we're standing, the photographer says, will you guys move over? We're trying to do this in twilight, which is the best time for outdoor photography. Like, well, there's no glare from the sun, but there's beautiful light. So Randy, will you back up a little bit? Fred, move over there. And you're trying to get the four of us into a picture. And as I back up, I fall over backwards. And I look in the grass, and there's something wooden in the grass. I say to Fred, and he's saying, that's a perfect spot. I say, I can't stand here. One leg's up, one leg's down. I said to Fred and Timmy, help me lift this up. And we lift this up. It's a gigantic 8-foot wooden gear. And I look at it and go, holy cow. Fred said, this looks like an overdrive gear from a Ferrari. It'll be our album cover. And so if you look at the back of BTO1, we're actually holding up that gear. And then we replicated it for the front with the BTO and the Canadian Maple Leaf and stuff to show we were Canadian. But that wooden gear, I then went and bought it. It was 8 feet across. It was a wooden gear that they used to make molds for, to really pour in metal to make gears for lumber mills in BC. So it was a real overdrive gear mocked up in wood. And so we had this wonderful name and the logo with the BTO in it, and we put gears around it. And out of happenstance or circumstance, we ended up with this great logo and this great gear. Now I got it back.
Do you mind going way back to the Guess Who? Before any hits, you did Shaken All Over. That became some level of a hit, I guess, yeah, in Canada, but also even on, you know, like you got like top 30 or something down here. I remember, go ahead.
It got to 18 in Billboard, and for the year it was in the top 50. It was, no, 58 in the for the top year, and then it was 18 with the highest it got in Billboard. We're still in high school.
Amazing. And but that opens the door. I mean, you're out touring after that, are you not, as a Guess Who?
After that, we got a call from Scepter Records in New York, Florence Greenberg, who owned the label. She also wrote Soldier Boy and managed the Shirelles. She also had Dionne Warwick on her label. And she had the Kingsmen on Wand Records. And Louie Louie and Jolly Green Giant were a big hit then, Little Latin Loop-de-doo. So she said, come to New York. I've got a manager here, Paul Cantor. He'll manage you guys. And you go on the Kingsmen Louie Louie tour. Great. I walk out of school. 2 weeks before my final exam, I walk out of school. I cleared up my locker. And we go to New York and we tour with the Kingsmen. But on the bus is Dionne and the Belmonts. The Kingsmen had their own bus. On our bus is Barbara Mason, who had a song, Are You Ready? Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, the Turtles join in the end. And the Guess Who are on the bus. We have one song, Shaken All Over. And it was fantastic. But since she managed the Shirelles, they were like black chicks who sang in a studio with musicians. She also had something to do with the Crystals, which was Ron and the Ronettes. Mm-hmm. So suddenly we are a jukebox band in Winnipeg. We played what was on the radio. So we go to New York and they say, can you copy to Do Run Run and He's a Rebel? We hear it once, we sound like the record. So we go on tour, we're four white guys backing three or four black chicks who are doing their hits, like to Do Run Run and He's a Rebel and mm-hmm. Soldier Boy. So we're backing three or four of these bands, the Shirelles, the Ronettes, the Crystals. And which is okay in New York. The minute we go out of New York, this is like 65, 66, there's race riots. White guys backing up black girls. We'd go into a restaurant or a gas station, guys would literally come out with a shotgun and shoot it over our head saying, you can't come in here. You can come in here, but you can't come in here. And we're from Winnipeg. When you grow up in Winnipeg, everybody was white. It was all immigrants that came. And when somebody black came to town, they were a hero. The only blacks we knew were Joe Brown, the boxer. Do you know what I mean? Hank Aaron, the guy who hit home runs. Every black that we knew was like a hero. We'd see them in the movies. Then the Supremes come out. Marvin Gaye. We loved black people because they were heroic to us. And so we couldn't see this thing going on in the state, the racial thing, but it was really a rough time for the black artists. And out of that came Motown. And we did a lot of tour with Motown acts. And so we got a really great rock and roll summer. When we came back to Winnipeg, our lead singer, Chad Allen, said, "Nobody knows who I am anymore. They all call us Guess Who. There's no Chad Allen in the Reflections or Expressions. I'm going back to school." He went back to school. When we left town in Winnipeg, we were the top band. We were gone for 3 months. The next band took our place. The Devrons. Their lead singer was Burton Cummings. Mm-hmm. We get back to town. Our lead singer and the leader of the band quits. I become leader of the band just because I'm the guy who takes the reins, because we're all set to split up. And my dad had gone to school with Rhoda Cummings, Burton's mother. And I said, "I think I want to get this guy Burton in my band." So he calls Burton's mother. She sets up an appointment. I say to her, "I want your son in my band." She says, "Great. You could be his older brother. You're 3 years older than him. Look after him. He could be in your band." Because she had to sign the contract. He was 16 or 17. He was under 18. So she wouldn't sign the contract unless I agreed to be his big brother and pick him up before the gig and bring him home after the gig so he could go to school the next day or do his homework.
He kind of gave up on school too, didn't he?
Yeah. He gave up on school. In the band, we got a television show that we had to play the top 40 all the time, which got very boring.
Which I used to watch, by the way.
Cool.
Ottawa. I remember you guys on Wednesday night, the Guess Who, every Wednesday for all the years.
Yeah. And so that was a big deal for every 2 years. But the hit parade then lasted 6 or 9 months. Now it lasts 6 weeks if you're lucky. So we started to repeat the songs. So the guy producing the show said, "Why don't you write your own material? And if it's good enough, we'll put you in between Lady Madonna and Fun, Fun, Fun. If it's good enough, we'll put you in between Hard Day's Night and Ruby Tuesday. It's got to be good enough to fit in between the Beatles and the Stones and the Beach Boys." So Burton and I start writing songs. We write No Time. We write She's Come Undone. We write These Eyes. He puts them in the show. Jack Richardson in Toronto, just like you, sees us playing original songs, calls us up and says, "I want you to do an album." That first album, the reason These Eyes sound so good on the radio to this day, it was cut at A&R Studios in New York, and Phil Ramone was our engineer. Wow. He owned the studio. He had guys named Dave Green and Elliot Shiner, who are still big, and Shelly Yakis, they're still big producers to this day. They're all doing remixes and surround sound on Eagles and everybody else. But we were very fortunate, and I'd known Phil Ramone from earlier when I went to Scepter Records. Dionne Warwick cut in his studio. So I'd go to Phil Ramone's studio. Burt Bacharach's there leading the orchestra. Dionne Warwick singing. I'm in the corner watching Phil and Dave Green, the engineer. And I learned production and I learned sound. I learned what to do. And I learned arranging just from being there. And Phil Ramone's a really wonderful guy. He let me sit in the corner. He would take me home for dinner to his apartment with his beautiful wife, play me jazz records of Tal Farlow, who was a big influence on my name, my son, Tal. Tal Bachman, named after Tal Farrell. And I learned how to produce, being with Jack Richardson's when it's time for BTO and nobody will work with me because I left the top band in the world. I end up producing myself because I've learned all this from Jack and Phil Ramone. So I produced BTO, and you know the story of that. So
sure. This is going on, as you mentioned, at a very young age. Yeah, you walked out of school 2 weeks before the finals and all that sort of stuff. There had to be this mind explosion at some point. You're on stage with women who've had huge hits, all of this out of Winnipeg. You know, was there a moment you went, "What's going on?" Or just went with it?
You kind of go with it because you got to realize back then there was no communication. To phone home every night, you had to save your money.
Yeah,
you have to phone long distance. Then the hotel would charge you. You'd call home for 2 minutes. It would cost you $30. And you're making $30 that night, each guy. There's no internet. There wasn't even any faxes. So you're kind of isolated on the road. You don't know. You're living day to day to day. And you call your agent. You say, "Go tomorrow to Peoria, Illinois. There's a place called the Static Attic. You'll see Richard Pryor's name up there. He's a comedian. He's opening his show. You're going after, or you're opening his show or whatever." And then you'd go and do the gig at $300 or $400. And then you call the agent again. And so you're going on and on, and you're not realizing that there's a momentum building. And I remember finally when faxes came in, I would check in, it'd be a fax for me at a hotel and say where to go, what time to show up, how much we get paid, and where the next gig was. And we finally get a fax that goes, American Woman is number one. No Time is 28. Let It Ride is 18. You've got three songs in the top 50. You've got three albums in the top 50. You know, that kind of thing going on. And it was amazing. I remember telling the guys in the band, we're number one. We got on the bed, four of us got on the bed in the hotel, jumping up and down, going, we're number one. We're number one. And then the bed caved in. We went to the other bed because there was a twin bedroom. And we had to go to the gig and get $750 with a number one record. Wow. Then I had to leave the band. I made a mistake there. I said, when we hit number one again, was when Charlie Fash called. With We Ain't Seen Nothing Yet being number one. It's the same thing. You get a phone call saying you've hit number one album and single, and you go crazy. That's when your mind explodes. And like, because you want to be on the Billboard charts, you want to be bubbling under. Then you want to be in the top 200, then the top 100, then the top 10. Then you get a gold record. Then you want a platinum record. It's all these dreams you have. And suddenly, what's the most ultimate dream? The number one spot.
Yeah.
But after that, where else do you go? Down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you came back up.
Yeah.
Do you remember in the early days at Mercury Records, you came to Chicago where it was headquartered? And people were telling you, we were like warning you that it's difficult to have lightning strike twice. So you'd had this great career with the Guess Who. The executives were saying, I think it was like just out of concern, they didn't want you to be totally let down. So they were saying, this is just hitting, having another band with the same guy may not work that well. Do you remember that at all?
I remember it very well. And I said, screw you. And we sold more records with BTO in less time, half the amount of years, than the Guess Who. It was just an explosion. I mean, Charlie was kind of given the task of bringing back Mercury Records. And who did he sign? He signed Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
Right, who then had the hit with Maggie May, and boom, then he signed BTO. Because you had lost to Riot Heap and a couple other bands had left Mercury. Everyone was going to Jack Holtzman at Elektra and A&M and RCA and stuff like that. So we were all Charlie had. Then later on, he signed Rush, who were huge. So Charlie signed two great Canadian bands, Rush, the prog rock, and us, the classic rock.
He didn't actually sign Rush, but he was the president of the company at the time.
Yeah.
Cliff Bernstein signed Rush. Yeah. But all right. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm out of time. Believe it or not, I'm supposed to, in 15 minutes, meet up with Skunk Baxter.
Say hi to him.
I will.
My son just saw him at the NAMM show.
Yes, he was down there this weekend.
Yeah.
That's great.
You're going to ask me about these eyes, but we can do that some other time.
Yeah. That's such an incredible song to this day. It doesn't run out of steam. Soon as you hear that piano at the beginning, it's crank it up.
That was me on the piano.
Was it?
I sat down and wrote that song on that little riff. And Burton said, that's so simple, I would never do anything like that. Because he's grade 12 classical piano. He's boogie woogie, Fats Waller, Fats Domino. Uh-huh. So I sit down and I go, in the key of C, boom, boom. He goes, wow, that's so simple. It's amazing. And I go down to the A minor. Oh, that's really simple. Simplicity works in cells.
Yeah.
And then I threw in all these jazz chords. There's like 26 chords in these eyes. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds like a three chord song. There's all major sevenths and minor sevenths and minor sevenths with a two bottom on the stuff. It's really, I had people dissect the song saying, this is an incredible jazz song. So
I wonder like there's people out there, not just in Canada now, who they're local bands, cover bands, whatever it might be, thinking These Eyes is easy and start trying to play it. I bet you they got tripped over a few times.
Yeah, they can't play it properly. Unless they go to YouTube, I'm showing you how to play it. I had guys say, what are the chords? Where you go, da-da-da-da-da-da. What's F major 7th with a G on the bottom? That's yeah. almost like that's almost like the Hard Day's Night chord. That brang, it's like a weird chord, but it fit perfectly in the song.
Yeah, great song.
All right, well,
great talking with you and seeing you. And
cool.
There's a lot to talk about. We should try this again sometime.
Anytime.
All right, man. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Mike Gormley Show is brought to you by Evolve Entertainment and The Jeremiah Show. Executive producer Jeremiah D. Higgins. Your host is Mike Gormley. Producer and sound engineer Graham Palmer at Surprise Studio. The Mike Gormley Show theme song is Jeff Skunk Baxter's track Ladies from Hell from the Speed of Heat album. Pick up your copy at jeffskunkbaxter.com. Follow and subscribe to The Real Jeremiah Show on YouTube and all podcast platforms. Let Mike Gormley help your music career. Go to laperesdev.com. Find all of The Jeremiah Show and Mike Gormley's past interviews on thejeremiahshow.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.